The James Beard Foundation is a nonprofit with the mission to celebrate, nurture, and honor chefs and other leaders, making America's food culture more delicious, diverse, and sustainable for everyone. And right now, it's working to respond to the dire situation the food and beverage community is in due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Restaurants, bars, and other independent food and beverage operations are often on the front lines of community revival. The majority of culinary community businesses have less than 500 employees, but collectively this industry generates $1 trillion a year, 60% of which is pumped back into their local business communities. To help bring swift economic relief to these essential businesses, the James Beard Foundation launched a fund to provide microgrants to independent food and beverage businesses in need. You can donate at jamesbeard.org/relief.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's March 31st. This is a special COVID episode of Beer Sessions Radio. We're all recording remotely. We're going to introduce a different guest, and we'll be talking about cask ale, which is a pretty nice subject to talk about when we're all confined to our homes. So I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here at Heritage Radio Network. And then I'll ask Paul Pendyke to introduce himself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Paul Pendyke from UK Brewing Supplies. I supply cask ale equipment to the industry, and primarily in the USA, but also in further afield.
Great. And now Steve Hamburg.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Steve Hamburg. I represent Caskmark Americas, which is the Caskmark certification program's representative in the United States. Caskmark in the UK has over 10,000 pubs. In the US, we have about a dozen.
Great. Greg Engert.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg Engert, coming to you from Washington, D.C. I have a number of bars and restaurants down here, but also the Grand Delancey in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Great. Tony Forder.
Hi, everyone. This is Tony Forder, Ale Street News. Like Paul, a native Brit.
All right. And then we'll bring it to Michael from Duchess Ales. Give an intro, and then we're going to talk about how we brought the show together.
Okay. Hey, guys. This is Michael Messini with Duchess Ales in New York State, specializing in cask ales.
That's great. So, Michael, we've been talking about having you on for a while. And just give us a little backstory on Duchess Ales and why you have a cask focus. And then we'll get more into the conversation.
Yeah, okay. Well, I originally come from California, and I didn't really, my first exposure to beer was sort of more of the West Coast craft beer scene. But soon after college, I was living in the UK for a little bit, and then frequently returning, at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, living there on and off. And this is really where I first fell in love. I found my beer, as it were, and fell in love with traditional cask ales and those balanced beers of the UK. So Duchess Ales is kind of an attempt to reflect those passions. We started, should I get into a little bit of the full history of the origins of the brewery? Or
yeah, a little bit about what you're okay. doing, yes.
Yeah, well, we started about 2013. We got our license in 2015. And our goal at that time was to make exclusively cask ales. Everything we made went to either Pins or Firkins, supplied by our friend Paul. And, this was a little bit commercial suicide, as it were, because there's, as I'm sure we'll talk about, there aren't that many places to serve this type of beer. But it was really the passion that I had and the passion my business partner Tim had. These are the beers that we wanted to drink. These are the beers that we couldn't find anywhere, be it cask or keg. We couldn't find balanced, reasonable, lower ABV, delicious beers to drink. So we just did it ourselves. And then being a little bit idealistic about the whole thing, when we went pro, as it were, and got our license, we stuck with just producing cask ales. We've expanded on from that now because we need to at least try to make some semblance of a profit. But still producing cask ales and trying to make every beer, first and foremost, drink great coming from cask. That's always how I'm envisioning the beer, what it's going to taste like coming out of a beer engine.
Great. So let's get some more.
A little bit about it.
Thanks, Michael. We'll get some more backstories. Yeah. Let's go with Steve Hamburg. Steve, for 20 years, you've been trying to promote and get more people aware of cask ales in America. And yet, you keep running up against it. It's really not catching on. Sometimes it's not being done properly. Give us your backstory and how you first got involved with it. I know you had an Oregon Cask Festival over 20 years ago.
Well, my story is similar, I guess, to Mike's in that I'm not from the UK. I'm a Washingtonian by birth and upbringing, and I have lived in Chicago where I've been since the 70s, where I came for grad school, and then very much got involved in the homebrewing scene. But I really got into cask ale in the 80s through my IT profession. Luckily, the company I work for had a branch in the UK. And in my travels, my colleagues there introduced me to root. And it was an eye-opener. And I think the joy of being in pubs is something I really thought I wanted to share with my friends back home. I guess my first trips, serious trips, started in the late 1980s. So I'd say 1987, 88. And then I got more and more into it and started to travel there more frequently. And through my connections with Mark Dorber, who is a well-known cellarman in the UK, I had met him through my travels and eventually forced him to give me some training in doing cask properly. And he had me come into the pub and like work in the cellar. So that's how I kind of was taught the ropes. It's been a battle, I think. I started writing articles for Zymergy, focusing on the production of cask ales, but also just being sessionable beers like bitter or mild. The old joke I have with cask ale in terms of the promotion is that we started the Real Ale Festival in like 1996. And a new beer writer, Stan Hieronymus, who was living in Peoria, Illinois at the time, he had come up and we had a long conversation. He said, In the world of good beer, where is cask beer? And I said, well, if craft beer, which was kind of a neat thing then, is a niche product, then cask ale is a niche of a niche of a niche. And every time I see Stan, which is thankfully enough regularly, at least annually, and every time he sees me, he always says, okay, I have to ask you, is it still a niche of a niche of a niche? And I have to say, in the United States, that's definitely what it is.
Well, that's great, Steve. So a little backstory. I mean, I think that Tony Forder, you want to tell us a little bit about Camera and Real Ale. I just want to say that for my era of craft beer, there's been a lot of misunderstanding and very few people have had a true cask conditioned ale. What's so great about it? Because usually, we don't have an example to compare it to.
Hi, Jimmy. You're talking to me?
Yes, Tony.
Okay, yeah. Well, the beauty of cask conditioned beer and why it's popular is it's because it's naturally fermented. It has natural carbonation. So when it is put in the cask, instead of adding CO2 to create the bubbles, additional yeast is added, and then it re-ferments in the cask. And it results in a softer, some say more purer, flavor of beer. And you don't get this gassy feeling in your stomach. Some people call it flat, but that's really not true.
Yeah, I know that Steve, what Steve was saying when he mentioned the cellarman, there's a role of a person in these traditional ales. And I do feel that that with technology, that that person's job's been eliminated. It seems that if we really want craft, we need to have people involved. Paul Pendyke, you've kind of dedicated your business in the States, UK Brewing Supply, to promoting cask ale. So tell us about your backstory, why you love cask ales, and the journey you've been on. I know it's hard being a cask ale promoter in the States.
Yeah, absolutely. I first started getting involved in importing products because I was an avid home brewer and I got sick of dealing with Cornelius kegs, so I wanted to try and get some pins. I saw an ad in a trade publication in the UK for a company over there that was supplying cask cooling equipment primarily to the industry. I contacted them, said, is anybody representing you in the US? And they said, well, actually, we've just sent a bunch of stuff over to the US for the Real Ale Festival, which Steve mentioned earlier. So we established a relationship. I found a guy that had some used firkins. I got Ale Street News, I think it was, looked around, spoke to a guy up in New Jersey, and he said that Jim Lutz at Wild Goose was looking for some casks. I contacted him. He said he'd take 100. I didn't even have a company formed at that point in time. I said, well, can you send me a check for 50%, which he did, payable to me personally. I always remember this fondly. We'd never even met, you know, and he sent me quite a few grand. And that's really what kicked it off. You know, I mean, I agree with Steve. It's still a niche of a niche of a niche. And actually, it's becoming a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche, I think, over the past few years, unfortunately. The sad part is that if you do it right, and maybe Greg will be able to verify this, but, you know, I used to own a British pub in PA, where we have two beer engines and cask ale on all the time, variety of beers. We do get some British beers in there. We have a local brewery that brews a mild at 3.2% and an ordinary bit for 3.8%. If you do it right and you get your staff behind it, it can really become a great seller. Because I think when people get in tune with this fact that I can go and I can drink beer pretty well all night at 3.2%. You know, if you have a bite to eat, you're not like kind of pouring them down your throat. And it really then is a session beer. And that's the objective of it. You know, I mean, that's the beauty of it in my mind. You know, the lower carbonation, the warmer temperature enhances the flavor in any beer. And, you know, it's just a great quaff. You know, I mean, you can really quaff it down. So it'd be great to see it become more popular in the US, but you've got to get the people that have the passion, that want to do it right, have some pride in the product that they're putting across the bar. And unfortunately, I think that's a little lacking.
Thank you, Paul. Just before we get to Greg, I want to say I've tried to be an advocate for cask ale. At one time, I had a setup from you, Paul, and we had the biggest issue was getting a cask condition keg. You know, we would have Ridgeways or Coniston's coming in from England, but they were very expensive. And we really didn't have anyone that I knew regularly who was making it. But Greg, I'm really impressed that you have cask condition ales with a hand pull at Grand Delancey. So tell us your experience with it, because you're really kind of our senior pub, good beer operator.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. You know, I think the first thing about real ale is, to your point about expense, if at this point, if you want to showcase real ale, you have to make it accessible to the public. And so to that end, we found out a long time ago that it was better to charge a price that was affordable and accessible to make sure that the beer would move, rather than maybe trying to get the same markup we would get on draft beer. So, you know, real ale is truly a labor of love for us, and we believe it should be served in large portions. You know, we serve all of our real ale in 20-ounce imperial pints, and we want people to to enjoy real ale, you know, in a sessionable way and not break the bank. We found that when we used to charge more for it, oftentimes the firkins would go bad. We wouldn't get through everything in time, and so we ended up dumping some of the beer. And so we just said, you know, let's just make this something that everybody can be introduced to, everybody can enjoy, and it's worked out. In D.C. And Northern Virginia, I think we have 16 different hand pumps across our properties, including Church Key, Blue Jacket, which is our brewery, the two Rusticos in Virginia, Evening Star Cafe, and Columbia Firehouse. We added two more hand pumps in New York City at the Grand Delancey. And, you know, we find that, yes, it's niche, but if it's priced right, and if it's well taken care of, people really love it.
Greg, are you serving only English ales on cask, or do you have any American breweries that are making it with you?
Oh, no. So we serve American breweries. In fact, you know, Michael's a friend, and I love the work that he does at Dutch Sales. We've served a lot of his casks at Grand Delancey since opening back in November. But, yeah, we're not particular necessarily about where it comes from, but what we are extremely particular about are the styles. So, you know, we are looking to showcase classic British style beer from cask, but we love it when American brewers like Dutch's Ales do it so well. So what we aren't looking to do, though, is to use the firkin and the cask engine as just a means to showcase another spin on an American double IPA or something like that. And for a long time, I think that had gained a lot of popularity to have, you know, an imperial sweet stout with tons of different adjuncts in it. We're looking to pour bitter, milds, porters, dry stouts, really aiming to be under 5% at all times, because we feel that these beers are best showcased by cask presentation. And that, frankly, I just don't think you can get malt-driven beers, low-alcohol malt-driven beers, just don't impress and show their true selves the way they do from cask.
That's great, Greg. It's funny because, yeah, about 10 or 12 years ago, it seemed that every time there was a cask festival, it was an excuse for a brewery to make a really random, over-the-top beer that you wouldn't usually even buy. So, Steve, you're back on.
Yeah.
You know, you've been doing this for 20 years. Want to mention a few breweries that have been devotees of the true cask style, and rather than just breweries that kind of jumped on when it was a fad?
Well, I think there were always, at the earliest days when we were doing our cask fest, there were very few people who had the equipment. So let's just talk about the evolution. When we first did the Real Ale Festival in Chicago in 96, the only brewers there were like two brewers in the United States who provided casks to us, who actually had casks. Most people sent their beer, the U.S. brewers at least, sent it in Hoff Stevens or Sankey's or even old Golden Gate casks, because we just didn't have the firkins at the time. And there were one or two in the Northeast and New York, like in Manhattan specifically, there were a couple of places that had access to casks. But we did bring beer from the UK. And I think people were inspired after that to get casks and do their beer properly. And as our fest evolved over the next few years, it got to the point where it was no problem getting beers in cask, at least from U.S. brewers. And guys like Paul stepped in and provided the breweries with an easier way to get casks. Pims came much later, so they inevitably were firkins. And I have to say, at the beginning, although we had beers in a lot of different styles, predominantly, the beers were pretty classic British styles. And the goofiness that we started to see, that is really kind of the second round in the craft brewing industry, where many of us who have done cast for a while, we joke now that what is the shive hole? That's the large bunghole on a cask. We say, what's that for? Well, brewers today look at it and say, what the hell can I put in that hole? We prefer beer and maybe some dry hops. But now it's become, you know, this, you know, back up the truck and dump as much stuff and pink peppercorns and all sorts of crazy additions that are non-traditional. And yet it really goes against the grain, because what happens is that it's bad. It's hard enough to get a beer to be good in a cask, to get your carbonation right, to get the balance right, and to serve it where it's in beautiful shape. Without putting all these other additions in, those are new variables that make it harder to serve a beer that has balance or is presented well, that has good carbonation. So we're now all over the place. And the joke now is, even in the UK, we started to see that clarity, which is really should be a hallmark of cask ale, even clarity has gone down, because it's become so popular to have hazy beers. And yet the cask itself is designed to help produce really bright, clear beer.
Thank you, Steve. So, does someone want to jump on to what Steve was saying?
Well, this is Mike here. I mean, it's funny. The first time I heard Steve say that, I went to a function that Paul put on down in Pennsylvania, and I think he had the whole room laughing because everybody was thinking the same thing as he said it. You know, the joke about the just because the cask has a hole in the top doesn't really mean it's a license to put whatever you'd like in there. And I think that is something that, and you know, Steve has already said it, but I think that is something that's set the cask game back a little bit here in the U.S. that I think a lot of people have gone into bars and had pretty disgusting cask ales. One I recall, I'm not going to say where I had it, in case this dear man's listening, but I had a jalapeno stout on cask that was almost kicked. So as you can imagine, at the bottom of the firkin was probably 3 pounds of jalapenos. And I don't think it occurred to the brewer that when the cask got low, it was just going to be incredibly bitter and foul. And I think things like that have not really helped the cask beer scene in the U.S., but I'm sure all have stories like that.
And we have a million of them. And Michael, so you as a brewer, tell us what you're doing that's different when you're brewing a beer for cask than a typical craft brewer would for non-cask. Just give us a little of the basics technically, because I do know that, and from what Steve said, there was traditionally a role of a cellar person, which was the added finishing of a cask. But tell us what steps you're doing in the brewery.
Well, I mean, I package all my casks. And first and foremost, every beer I make, as I mentioned in my introduction, is a beer that I envision drinking out of a cask, well served. So, I mean, I'm really focusing on making all the beers we have in our current lineup, which is about 6 beers, are all under 5.4%. And they all have what I feel like is good balance. And I think that is something that is also really important going forward, that I think producers of cask ale need to kind of accept where the U.S. market's palate is. And I don't think beers need to be quite overly malty. Our beers certainly have a pronounced malt quality, and I really try to focus on using the highest quality malt products and really accentuating that. But at the end of the day, I'm trying to balance that with hop bitterness, with the weight of the beer. And I think if people were drinking beers like that consistently from cask, I think there's a bright future for it. But what I do is really just to make sure that when it leaves the brewery, it is primed properly to, you know, taking into account maybe 10 days, 2 weeks of conditioning by the time it turns up at somewhere like Grand Delancey for Greg to tap, that it's in optimal condition. Of course, these things are, I have a distributor, so sometimes these things are out of my hands. You know, in a perfect world, I'd be delivering these directly to a pub. But I think so, the Michael, best I can do is
Michael,
send it off.
Excuse me.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah. So you're saying an ideal, and traditionally, the keg would have been delivered to the pub, and it would have undergone its conditioning in the pub cellar.
Exactly. But, yeah, the landlord would receive it, and he'd know that it needs about 10 days, and would sort of babysit it until it's ready. But nowadays, I don't think people are afforded that time. I don't think, for instance, Greg wants something sitting in his, you know, in his cold box for 2 weeks before he even gets to look at it. So what I try to do is prime it and then let people know about the date it's going to be drinking. So I'd say I like 10 days personally. I'm sure maybe Paul and Steve might have other ideas, or Greg. But yeah, I think that's the way I have to operate. But yeah, in the UK, obviously these things go right at, they get primed and they leave the brewery, and the landlords receive them with a packaging date and know approximately when that thing's going to be ready to drink.
Okay. I'm just going to keep talking to get things organized.
Okay.
Who would like to answer the question? I feel like, do you know of a cellar person in England who we could name, who you would say we should aspire to, or this is the person that really does their job the way that you need to properly serve cask ale?
Well, sure. Yeah, Jimmy, I mean, Steve mentioned him before, Mark Dorber, who used to be the cellarman at the White Horse and Parsons Green. He's most probably the most renowned cellar person in the UK, I would think. Steve, if you disagree, jump in. But, you know, he was featured. I don't know if anybody's seen Michael Jackson's collection of videos, but Mark's in that, and now he has a pub. I think it's in East Anglia.
He has two pubs now.
But, but there's actually a lot of them that maybe aren't as famous. You know, I mean, there's a pub that I always go to just down the road from where my mum lives in London, a Young's pub, the Hare and Hounds, and whoever's handling the cellar there is doing a great job because you always get a great pint. So I think there's a lot of people in the UK that are doing a really good job. I'd like to jump in quickly, if I may, on Steve's comment. You know, that was part of the problem that, you know, the brewers, they hit a time when they looked at cask ale as an opportunity for them to experiment without them actually having to waste a whole batch. You know, they could just throw some crap in. I mean, I always joke, like, you know, they put a dead squirrel on that last week's dirty socks in there to see how it turned out. And, you know, that's part of the problem with the cask ale and has been over the past few years, is that really people aren't, or, you know, certain brewers are not really seeing what it's about. That the fact is that it can enhance what they're doing with the beers that they're producing if they do it correctly. And another thing that we haven't touched upon, and, you know, a friend of Steve's who he did the Real Ale Festival, and a friend of mine, of course, Ray Daniels, wrote a paper called The Perfect Pint. You know, what we've got to remember here is because this beer is still alive, it's still changing slightly. And Ray's analogy was that, you know, there'll be times when you will go into a pub and have a pint, and whether the moon is in the seventh house or wherever it is, it's like the perfect pint. I mean, I can remember driving through Yorkshire, and I just stopped at a pub for lunch, and I had a pint of Riding Bitter, and it was outstanding. I was in the Spotted Pig in New York, and I had a pint of their bitter, which I believe was produced by Brooklyn Brewery, and it was spot on. So that's one of the beauties of it as well, is that it's this thing is alive. It's not dead. It's still going on. So there's going to be slight differences whether you had a pint today and you go back to the pub and have it tomorrow. It's going to be slightly different. So unfortunately, I think a lot of brewers, you know, are missing that. And, you know, it's so easy to mask deficiencies in the beer by overpowering it with the ingredient, you know, of whatever you're going to put in, Himalayan sea salt or what, you know, who knows what the hell. So that's the sad part of it, actually. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox.
Oh, no, you're great, Paul. Thank you so much. And I'll tell you, we're going to go to a short break, but I just want to say, especially in these times, it's one more reason why we're trying to support local food and beer systems, because there's certain things that always taste better when they're local and when there's a person involved in that craft. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Restaurants employ over 15 million people nationwide, and two-thirds of all restaurants are independently owned and not part of big chains. Yet, currently, these small businesses are not represented in government relief negotiations. ROAR is working to change that by fighting for relief opportunities for all restaurants. ROAR is advocating for an 8-point plan in New York State that will allow restaurants to reopen and rehire when the time comes. Dozens of industry leaders have signed onto this plan, like Namwa Tea Parlor, Field Trip, Momofuku, and many more of your favorites. You can join them at change.org by searching for ROAR, Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it's that time of year. Become a member for heritageradionetwork.org. We're all going through a rough time, but this is a way to connect with a lot of people and support your food systems. Support heritageradionetwork.org. So we've got a great show right now. We're talking about cask ales, and to me, the beauty of cask ale, there's a lot of traditions. You know, Tony Forder, going back to Camara, you know, this was what English ale was. It was cask ale, real ale. But didn't Camara create the term real ale? I mean, what was it called before? Was it just called beer?
It was called traditional British ale, basically, served in the pubs on the hand pump. I mean, you do have to realize we wouldn't even be probably talking about cask beer if it wasn't for Camara, the campaign for real ale, which was basically a group that got started by four guys in 1973, I believe, which was coincidentally, that's about when I started entering official beer drinking age. And I took right to the local beer, which was kind of frowned on by my father. He didn't drink it. This was the days of when mass production was looked upon as a superior product to a local type product. So a lot of these, the bigger breweries were going, migrating to kegs because they were more efficient. They could do bigger volume. And the cask beer was getting left behind. And thanks to the campaign for real ale, really saved day for cask beer. Now, where I'm from in Sussex, England, the local brewery Harvey's was struggling back in the 70s, and now they've been going great guns for the last 20, 30 years, so, thanks to the survival of cask conditioned beer.
Oh, that's great, Tony. Yeah, no, it's very, very interesting history, and it seems that now the last 5 years with the rise of newer craft breweries, no one's really been talking about it. So, Michael, I'm really glad that you brought this up. So let's talk about the current cask ale advocates in the United States. So first, Michael, originally we had planned this show because it was a preview to NERAX, the New England Real Ale Fest. Tell us about NERAX and, you know, what we should know about the people that organized that.
Well, to be honest with you, we were this year would have been my second NERAX. Last year we were in NERAX, but I wasn't able to go because I had the flu. So I don't know the guys too well, but I know that it is the Northeast's longest running cask festival, and I know that they get a really good turnout every year. I mean, Greg may have been, maybe he could speak a little bit more to the actual festival. But they get a great turnout. They get brewers from all around the states giving beer to the festival, although it is kind of a New England Northeast focus. And they seem to really know their stuff. one of the guys who is involved in the organization, his name is Randy Barrell. He actually wrote a book called, I can't remember the name of the title, but it is essentially how to put on a cask ale festival. And it involves a pretty nice appendix about cellarmanship, which is really taken really probably verbatim from the kind of classic cellarmanship manual that's available. You can find on Amazon and what have you that I think maybe my copy came from Paul. But yeah, it's a wonderful festival that I wish we were involved in this year, but of course, like everything else, has been canceled.
Thank you, Michael. And I'll just give some shout outs. I mean, I first experienced Cask Fest and Cask in New York City, probably through Paul Pendyke, through some of his friends, Alec Hall. I know Chris Kuzme and Patrick Donaher were part of some Cask Fest. I know that at Fifth Hammer, they still are doing the Cascalot Festival. So that it's still going in the city. But for Greg, how do you work this into your business, and how can people make it better? You know, what's missing, and you know, let's get you back on.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, the thing about real ale is that it's something that people are often excited to try, and every person who tries it again when it's prepared properly comes back for it. So that to me just means that we have opportunity now that is not necessarily being embraced by a larger community, but it is definitely the opportunity is definitely there again, along with like proper beers, proper handling, and proper pricing. I think, you know, people like Paul Pendyke and Michael, you know, these are friends of mine who have been doing the right thing with real ale for a long time. And I think it's important for all of us to kind of band together to make sure that this happens. But it also takes some honesty about the beer itself. You know, we work with, you know, a lot of the same people that I think Nirax works with, like Shelton Brothers and Be United, to bring over real ale from the UK. Love to work with brewers like you know, Ridgeway and Coniston, like you mentioned, Fine Ales, Moore Beer Company, Harvestoon. From time to time, Harvey's even makes its way over here, which is my favorite real ale. But you have to care for it, and if it's not right, you have to pull it. You have to report it, and we have to be honest about the losses we're going to take regarding it. You know, again, this is not a beer that's going to drive huge margins. In some ways, it can be a loss leader, but it reminds people why it is so important. And this is especially kind of pertinent and surreal to say right now, why it was and will again be so important to leave your home and drink at bars and restaurants socially. You know, talking about this right now, I know I cannot drink real ale at home. And this is something that I think is so cool when we think about why should we encourage people not just to line up for canned beer, trade it online and drink it surreptitiously in their homes, and, you know, always trying to give people reasons to come out to beer bars, go out to the best pubs, go out to restaurants and drink beer. I think Cascale is one of the best examples for that. If you can go out and drink great Cascale, this is an experience you cannot replicate at home. So when all this is kind of said and done and we can get back to it, I hope that other publicans join us in pushing that agenda and getting people to experience flavors and textures that they can't experience otherwise.
Thank you, Greg. I'm going to make a toast to you. If anybody has a glass, wow, they can cheers. Toast. It's a quick moment. Let's just everyone go around and say if they're drinking a beer, what they're drinking. So I'm drinking the closest thing I can get. My corner deli, you can see the supplies running down. It's either mass market, like seltzers and some of the bigger craft breweries, or luckily a few local breweries. But I'm drinking Samuel Smith's Imperial Stout. It's not really a cask, but it's English. Tony, what are you drinking?
Well, I'm supporting my local brewery. I am drinking a Ramstein Maybach.
Excellent. Greg, what are you drinking?
I also couldn't get my hands on something more cask appropriate, but I did bust out. I have an Otto from the Wood from 2013, Hair of the Dog, bottle condition. It held up beautifully.
Great. And Paul, what are you drinking?
it's the effect of the 2009 Fuller's Vintage Ale that I'm drinking. Yeah, it's really excellent, actually. I usually save these. I had two bottles of these. I usually drink one on New Year's Eve. I think I've got up to about 2015, but this one is particularly good. Sometimes they come out a bit muddy looking, but this one is absolutely bright, clear as a bell. It's really superb.
Well, I was talking about, you know, the mystique of a good cask ale. I was reading an English murder thriller. Can't remember the author, but the high moment was that he went into a dingy pub in his area, and there happened to be a Fuller's handle, and he ordered it, and it was one of the finest hand-pulled ales he had had in England as an Englishman. So there's a lot of beautiful memories and mystiques. But let's go to Steve Hamburg. Steve, you know, you can read about the background of Camera. There's a lot of information about it. And that really was, as Tony said, that was a whole nother generation ago. So Cass Mark came to the United States a few years ago. And Steve, tell us about that process and where it's at. And why is Cass Mark important for the United States? I mean, there's thousands of Cass Mark pubs in England. And how many are here in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I'm drinking an off-color milk stout, just so you know. So I have one of my local beers.
Great selection.
There you go. Cask Mark was formed in 1998 in the U.K. In fact, I remember when it was rolled out. And basically, it was an industry-sponsored initiative. Primarily from about four or five different brewers who were aghast at the low quality of that their own beers that were produced at places like Fuller's. Fuller's was an early adopter of the cask mark scheme. But they found that when their beer left the brewery and went to trade, and particularly if it wasn't within their own pubs, that they found that the beers were indifferently looked at. And they were appalled at the overall quality. So the Cask Mark accreditation, so it's basically an independent inspection. And it's an award given to the cellar person at the pub. So if there's a change in staff, for example, at that pub, where that the cellarman leaves to go somewhere else, they have to be reaccredited. The initial accreditation, it's an independent sort of blind inspection. So usually either a retired brewer or someone who has a trained palate makes an unannounced visit to the pub and shows their identification. And they're given up to six of the beers that are on offer. And they are assessed in four different levels: for temperature, for clarity, for aroma, and for flavor. And there's a 20-point scale, and all beers have to achieve 16 on the 20-point scale. So it took a while, I think, for it to be widely adopted in the UK. But as I said, there are over 10,000 pubs now who have earned the accreditation. What's really good from a consumer standpoint is it's become a means beyond just looking at it. It used to be you'd get the Campaign for Real Ale's Good Beer Guide, and people would look for pubs that are in the Good Beer Guide. But that was often pubs were in the Good Beer Guide because people just thought the pubs were cool, and the beers actually were not always that well served. Cask Mark was a little bit different in that it focused solely on the quality of the beer being served. So it didn't matter whether you had a bad experience with the landlord or, hey, I don't like going there, or I think this guy's an asshole. If the beers are really good and they pass these inspections, then they win the Cask Mark. So from a consumer standpoint, when you see the Cask Mark and there's a shield that's displayed outside the pub, And often there's special certificates that are displayed in the pub. But the consumer sees it, and they know that, hey, this place knows how to serve it. And by the way, if the consumer gets a subpar pint in those pubs, they can report it to Caskmark, and these places are reinspected. So in the U.S., it's been a difficult sale. Paul Pendyke was doing this beforehand, and he could tell you how difficult it is to get pubs to be interested in the scheme, mainly because the U.S. is such a big country, and there are only so many places around the country that are seriously into serving cask ale. And they don't have the enthusiasm to seek the sort of certification. And also, it just doesn't have any meaning, because Caskmark is the cask ale is so traditional to Great Britain. Even if most people don't drink cask ales in Britain, they're still familiar with traditional ales. In the U.S., people have no idea what they are. They just think the Brits drink warm, flat, and cloudy beer. So I think there's a place for Caskmark here, but it takes much more of a passion from the pub operator. And I think there's a greater chance to see it now that there are more tap rooms where the brewers themselves can look after the beers on premises. Right now, there are only about a dozen places across in the United States who have the Caskmark certification. And I'm always working to get others in. So if Greg wants to get his guys in the program, I'd love to have them.
Okay, let's get Paul on following up on that.
Yeah, hi, Jimmy. Yeah, I as Steve mentioned, you know, I got involved with Caskmark a number of years ago. And, you know, Steve's absolutely correct. I mean, it's a tough sell. You know, there's a number of places that are doing a great job and, you know, deserve to have it on display. But again, you know, it is a tough sell. There's no doubt about it. Again, like I mentioned earlier, you know, you've got to have somebody that's passionate about it, that cares about it. You know, it's not brain surgery, but it's more complicated than putting a keg on. So you really need someone that cares about it, you know, and the cellarman that's going to look after it and make sure the carbonation level is correct and the temperature, the clarity before he pushes that pint to the customer across the bar. But, you know, I've had some great pints in the US, but I've also had a lot of terrible cask pints as well, unfortunately. And that, in a way, makes it more difficult to establish any foothold because you haven't got that consistency. I mean, there's pubs in England that don't serve good cask ale, as Steve or Tony or anybody will confirm. But it's definitely easier to find ones that are serving good cask ale than it is in the US.
Great. Thank you, Paul. I mean, the great thing about American craft beer is that not just the great traditions of English or German or Belgian-style beers, there's so much that's happened in this country. It is hard to kind of pin down to a certain style. But I'd like to ask Michael, our good friend Chris Kuzme, now at Fifth Hammer Brewing, he asked a question, which I thought it's pretty technical. He says, the question is, to sparkler or not to sparkler? And if so, 0.6 millimeter or 0.1 millimeter? First, explain to us what the hell that means.
Well, the sparkler, I mean, Paul could get a little bit more technical with actually why. Well, I'll tell you why sparkle. I mean, generally, it's a northern thing because people in the north of England prefer to see a little bit of foam and head on the beer. Whereas in the south of England, Paul, of course, correct me if I'm wrong about this. But in the south, people are happier with a little bit more, less of a head on a pint. So the sparkler really fits onto the beer engine to essentially oxygenate, I believe, the beer as it leaves the beer engine, just to provide a little bit extra head and a little creaminess. I'm a no sparkler guy, but that's probably because the breweries that I have a lot of affinity for are generally in the south of England and the southwest of England, particularly.
And Paul?
Yeah, Michael's correct. It was more of a northern thing with the sparkler. I also think that, you know, that divide doesn't really exist like it used to, but I think some of the beers that were brewed in England could handle the sparkler because it will, you know, it will knock the carbonation out of the beer. It's making the carbonation come into the head and can also change the flavor profile. And I think some of the northern beers, and, you know, Steve can jump in here as well, but I think some of the northern beers, not so much necessarily today, but in the past, were ones that could handle that better than the, you know, the southern beers were a little bit more delicate. You know, when you get into breweries like, you know, Black Sheep, where they're still using Yorkshire Squares, which is a pretty interesting fermentation vessel where there's two levels and the yeast has to be recirculated and all this. You know, I think beers like that can handle the sparkler a bit better. I mean, when we had the pub, you know, to sparkle or not to sparkle, I used to, you know, kind of say it sort of depends on the beer. You know, I mean, I would say try it without the sparkler and try it with the sparkler and see which way you thought was the best. But yeah, I mean, down, you know, in London, I mean, a lot of the beer engines in the old days in London, you know, did not have that long swan neck, which would enable you to really use a sparkler. You know, when you use a sparkler correctly, you should, there's a tip on the end of a sparkler in most cases, and that should be touching the bottom of the glass. And then you should pull the pint and keep the sparkler beneath the head of the beer. Well, a lot of the beer engines that you see in the south of England, the old ones, the old Gaskell and chambers, the big cabinet models, you don't see that long swan neck, you know, so they're just pouring the beer into the into the side of the glass. And, you know, they used to utilize a piece of equipment called an auto vac. And I, last time I was up in Yorkshire, it was a number of years ago now, actually, but I saw this still being utilized in a pub. And what would happen is they would pull the pint, and as it overflowed into the drip tray, that would have a drain on it that would go back into the cask. Totally unhygienic, of course. But, you know, they'd really keep pumping and pumping and pumping and pumping this. And, you know, the result was it would look like a Guinness being poured, of course, you know. And I think that's where nitro beers came from, was to try and replicate the softer carbonation and that cascading effect of the carbonation that you would get with cask ale that was dispensed through a sparkler. So, yeah, Michael had it right.
And then we can say this, and we finally reached an agreement. It's that soft mouthfeel that a proper cask-conditioned ale has. That's the magic.
Well, yeah, the quality of the carbon dioxide is different, isn't it? When it undergoes the natural process rather than forced carbonation. Maybe technically it's a finer carbon dioxide, which is maybe leading towards what Paul was talking about, how sometimes you get almost the nitro feel. It's almost ineffable, the feeling of drinking a cask ale. Because it is such a fine mouthfeel, but I think it really is the quality of the carbon dioxide from the natural process. Paul, is there a little bit more technical on that?
Well, I mean, Steve had mostly jumped in. He's the technician, I think. But I think when you naturally carbonate it as opposed to forced carbonate it, I think the bubbles are smaller with natural carbonation.
Yeah.
And hence, I think that's why you get a softer mouthfeel.
Mm. Well, yeah, exactly. I will. Let me jump in. The one issue I've seen with the use of the sparkler, we can get there, is that the sparkler has been used by a lot of brewers to essentially make up for the fact that the beer that they have on is too flat to begin with. And so if you pour it without the sparkler, if you push it through, you get that temporary boost of apparent carbonation. It gets forced through the head. So it makes a flat beer even flatter, actually. Yeah. So the question really comes in from a technical side is you have to think about what the beer is and what it tastes like without the sparkler. So what a cellarman will do typically is assess the carbonation of the beer. And you can decide, now I think beers like stouts or porters or even certain milds where they benefit from having kind of a creamier mouthfeel. But others where you want to get that bitterness through a little bit better, like in a pint of bitter, a pale ale, even an IPA, you want a little carbonation. Otherwise, much of the hop character gets forced to the head. So you have to make that assessment as a cellarman to decide whether that beer really is more suitable. A lot of it is personal preference. But I think there's a tendency for all of us to think that all these beers are served. The natural carbonation level is so low that I hate to lose it carbonation. Now, the standard that most people hear is that you're aiming at one volume of CO2 in solution in a cask. Whereas in most pressurized American beers, we're talking well over two or to three, almost four volumes of CO2. Now, I think from a sellability standpoint, and I think Greg could certainly help on this one, is I think having a little bit more carbonation really helps in the American market. So I recommend to people to make sure to brewers when they're racking to make sure that they have more fermentables in the beer so that they have a livelier cask. If it's really lively, a cellarman can adjust that carbonation accordingly. But if there's no carbonation in that beer to begin with when you breach the cask, you just got a flat beer.
Thank you, Steve. Hey, Greg, we're going to wrap it up. But Greg, do you want to add anything before we close out?
Yeah, totally. And I totally agree with all of that. I mean, we have, you know, once upon a time, we eschewed sparklers and CO2 breathers and all these other things to try for really natural cask presentation. And that was wrong. I can say now that it's better to give us a fighting chance to make people love cask ale. And I think that CO2 breathers and sparklers help with that. But I definitely agree with all these points. I mean, for sure, if we have an active cask, we may not even use a sparkler, or we'll use the 0.6 millimeter. If one is not as active, we'll use the 1 millimeter sparkler. And then also to the same question about style. Certain beers that are supposed to be creamier, we use the smaller, or we use the large. The larger millimeter. And then those that need a little bit more sparkle, we'll go to the smaller millimeter. So I think it is important to think about which ones we're using. But at the end of the day, sparklers and breathers, I think, are our friends. I think they're going to be the things that are going to make more people trust cask ale for the time being. And who knows, 5-10 years from now, we may have some true cellarmen and cellarwomen who can handle casks in a way that breathers and sparklers aren't as needed.
Thank you, Greg. Guys, this was a great show. Michael at Dutch of Sales, thanks so much for helping to put this show together. Greg Engert of the Grand Delancey, Paul Pendyke of UK Brewing Supplies, Steve Hamburg, Cask Mark, and Tony Forder, Ale Street News. Thanks for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producer, Dylan Hoyer, and engineer, Matt Patterson. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, We at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the ways that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19, from interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how this crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.